You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 486.
Hello everyone and welcome back to The Outdoor Station on July the 25th, 2019, which is predicted to be the hottest day of the year in the UK since records began. Apparently, the current record is 38.5 degrees Celsius in Faversham, Kent, on the 10th of August 2003. Today, it looks like North London could hit 39 or 40 degrees Celsius. As a result of this warm weather, we have predictions and warnings of rail tracks being buckled in the heat, tarmac melting on the roads, FM and AM radio being disturbed, safety warnings for people tempted to jump into cold open water and suffering gasp reflex, heat stroke if your body temperature goes over 40 degrees C, and worst of all, the paparazzi snapping pictures of Boris Johnson in the garden of number 10 in nothing but his underpants. Okay, so perhaps I made that last bit up. However, recording this intro while sitting in my back garden, it suddenly seems like a jolly good idea. Back in podcast number 482, you may remember I spoke with Dermot Cosgrove, who was about to set off on a 620-kilometre trek north to south along Iceland, towing a hiking cart. We talked in detail about the route, the landscapes, the gear, the weather, his training and preparation for this self-supported adventure. He was more than ready. However, a few days in, something totally unexpected happened. And Dermot, keep in mind he's an ex-Foreign Legion military specialist, was forced to terminate the challenge and return home. Unfortunate for him, of course, but many of his followers and our listeners wanted to know in more detail what actually went wrong.
Well, what really went wrong was I had originally thought about bringing some road shoes, and then I went, well, no, I've been training in these boots for so long, for a year, and they're well broken in, so you know there won't be a problem. And when I actually got up there, there's a little bit more tarmac than was on my maps, because they've apparently gone on this mad tarmacking spree up there, and they've extended sections of which had previously been dirt road to make it asphalt. So I was having to deal with more of that, which asphalt is, I mean, like yourself and I'd say anyone else who does any long distance walking or hiking, you know, asphalt is really the bane of anyone's feet. So it was kind of a combination. I should have actually listened a bit more to my feet, but I was trying to recover some lost kilometers from the very first night that I got there because I was late getting to where my drop-off point was. It was raining quite heavily, so I said, right, I'm going to sack it for the evening. I'd done about 7 or 8 kilometers when I had intended on doing about 20. And then I was trying to recover those kilometers over a few days by, you know, picking up the pace as I went along. And that I should have listened to my feet when because it really came about in one day. I mean, I know if you've seen the photograph, it's a horrendous blister, but that really only came about in one day's walking. And I had done
what that second day? Do you think?
Third day.
The third day. Right.
Yeah. Third day. That evening when I got to my drop-off point and I walked the 8Ks, feet were fine. The following day I did 35Ks, feet were fine. The next day I did 35Ks, and just as that day ended, my feet were a little bit sore and I went, okay. I got up the following morning and I did put some padding on the front of my foot and I went, okay, well, I'm going to do 20Ks today and get as far as the Aspergy campgrounds where the Aspergy Gorge is and just get in there and have an earlier day, only do 20Ks, rest my feet, and then, you know, if I have to, I'll take a rest day the following day. And by the time I got five, I actually could see the campground from the hill I was on, and it was 5Ks away. And I started walking, and next thing I felt this squish, which was the fluid from the blister coming out between my toes. And my feet had started to swell at that point and they were getting a bit painful. So I ended up walking the last 5Ks as far as the campground in my Crocs.
So were all those days on tarmac?
The first long day of 35Ks was on a dirt road, which was fine. And then the other days were on tarmac when I should have still had a good 25Ks on dirt road. But they've tarmacked that road, you know, in between my maps being produced and any up-to-date data.
Gosh. I mean, it's very similar to an experience of mine where I did exactly the same thing. I arrived at my start point, felt fit, strong, the weather was good, and I pushed on. I did 2 days in the first day, and then I did another long day, and that second day was all asphalt. And that was it. That was the start of it. It was you know, the heat that comes off your feet, obviously, when you're trapped in the boots, and the amount of damage that causes, whether you're towing using a hiking cart or you're actually carrying a rucksack, is phenomenal. I think a lot of people just don't realise how much heat your feet give off.
This is true. And I mean, last year I had hiked in the Pyrenees and I'd done quite a bit of road work while I was there in the exact same boots. So they were well capable. The conditions at the time in June of last year were quite wet and my feet were fine. I had no problems with my feet whatsoever. But one Icelandic guy taught me that this is the warmest summer they've had so far in 15 years. And even though it was kind of 17, 18 degrees, my feet were just boiling. I was just going, it was wetter, but it was warmer in France. So I don't know if that was the difference where it didn't cause such havoc with my feet, but my feet were just ruined by the time I met it as far as the campground.
Well, I've certainly been following your story and obviously the pictures, and I must admit, I've been scratching my head because when we spoke, obviously, in the previous interview, you were in North Africa, you were in 40 degrees, you had the same boots, you were training in them, and I just couldn't understand how you could go to what supposedly is cooler temperatures, although, obviously, at those sort of temperatures, it was actually quite pleasant walking, I should imagine, to a situation where, you know, your feet sort of took on that damage. What do you think was the key thing? What could people take away from this?
I think people need to realize if they're going to walk on asphalt, they might want to and if it looks like they're going to have any prolonged days on asphalt, they should actually think about having a good, well-ventilated road shoe, like a non-Gore-Tex road shoe, where their feet can breathe a lot easier. I mean, I've got the handbag boots are seriously good quality boots, but they're leather and they're Gore-Tex because I was planning for misty, wet, wet days, which I had for the first 2 days, first day and a half. And they just built up far too much heat. And that, that combined with the way my foot was falling was just causing an uneven strike to the ground.
Do you think in hindsight that if you'd taken approach shoes, trail shoes, instead of Crocs, it would have made all the difference after that second day?
I think it would have. I actually think it would have. I think with a couple of days, a few more days rest and well padding my feet, I probably could have gone on that bit further. I'm not sure if I would have been able to complete it if it continued building up damage, but... I think the road shoe, if I'd started out using the road shoe and waited until I hit the Highland section where I was walking across that black sand, then it would have made all the difference.
And how about the amount of energy you were expelling using a hiking cart rather than carrying the rucksack? Did you notice a big difference in the amount of energy you were using?
I actually noticed I was able to just go on for longer. I mean, I stopped. I had planned on stopping for an hour or two in the middle of each day, having something to eat and then continuing on. And what I did was I stopped for about 45 minutes, brewed up some water and had some food, and then continued on after that. And I wasn't actually feeling tired. I had no fatigue. I was able to get to kind of my point that I wanted to stop at roughly kind of 7 in the evening and just stop there, set up camp, eat and relax, and I was fine. I noticed there was a lot less, I suppose you'd call it kind of drag that you'd feel on your shoulders from carrying a rucksack, and a lot less weight down through the body.
I suppose really you didn't sort of put the cart to too much of a test of it being just sort of dirt roads and tarmac. You hadn't actually sort of hit the hills as with it as such.
The ground was actually quite undulating, so there was a few points where I had to go up some, you know, reasonably steepish hills. I think the true test of it would have been crossing the highlands where I was onto that black sand, where there would have been a bit more of a drag on the wheels. So that would have been the real, you know, that this is what I was counting on. So I was able to make quite good time while I was on more compact ground. And it was, I won't say it was effortless, but it was a lot easier than walking with a rucksack.
So even though the walk only lasted the few days that it did, and obviously we're talking in a minute about the decision to cease and come back, did you find that everything else that you'd prepared for, that you took with you, all your equipment, everything basically performed as you hoped?
It did, and I'll say this much. God bless Exped, not wanting to give any particular company a plug, but Exped sleeping mats are absolutely fantastic because it's by far the best sleeping mat I've ever used. They use a bag system to inflate, and you know, I put it in there, and I was always used to with other inflatable sleeping pads of there being some deflation when you got up in the morning, but there was absolutely nothing. It didn't budge. I was kneeling on it. It was rock solid. It was perfect. Really helped to have a good night's sleep.
Absolutely. Well, certainly when you're doing any expedition, it's a good night's sleep makes all the difference. And I should imagine as time went by and you started to get a bit concerned about the health of your feet, you spent a lot of time lying on that mat staring at them.
Well, I did. I mean, I got as far as the campground in Aspergie, and I spent, I did my best to patch up my feet. I got rid of all the dead skin that was on it. I had a very good conversation with Keith Foskett, who called me up to offer advice and throw a few thoughts in. So I did as best as I could with my feet, but the problem was still having to walk to go as far as the bathrooms and showers and stuff like that. I was still walking on my feet, and there was an ooze, to describe it as best I can, still coming from the open skin, the fresh skin, which was a bit concerning because then I was worried about if any dirt gets on it, then risking getting an infection in my feet. And that's when I thought, well, I need to have someone else have a look at it and then see what can be done so that I could actually continue on. But unfortunately, the doctor kind of put paid to that when he said, well, you're gonna need a few more days.
And how did you feel when he said that?
Absolutely gutted. Absolutely gutted. I have never, I haven't had a problem with blisters since I was a young legionnaire, when we had, you know, brand new, very rough army boots. And I got very bad blisters at one point down my heels, not even on the underneath, but on the back of the heel. And I haven't had a problem with my feet since then. I've had jolts to the knee, I've had twists to my ankles and stuff like that, but I've never had a problem with my feet. So this is why this is just, it left me baffled.
Yeah, well, with your military background, I should imagine you've been through all sorts of conditions underfoot. And as you say, if you've managed to cope all right, it must have been a great shock and surprise.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a real letdown because I was feeling absolutely fine. I had no fatigue. I had no, you know, there was no muscle ache. There was nothing. I mean, my feet actually weren't even tired the way they can do it sometimes. It was just the bloody blisters.
Yeah. So what was the practicalities of getting away from where you were to get back? Because I know it was quite a few planes, trains and automobiles, etc., to actually get to the start point, the drop-off point. How did you return home?
Yeah, well, to get back, I mean, luckily enough, my contact up there who had brought me as far as the drop-off point, I was still in touch with him. So when I took the decision to actually, I need to get medical advice on my feet, I was able to give him a call, and he came across, picked me up at the campgrounds, and brought me back as far as the nearest big town, which was Húsavík. And I had another contact there who's a small hotel owner. So I was able to stay in his hostel for a few days and try and evaluate my feet from there. So that part was all right. Again, traveling in Iceland is a bit quirky. I mean, if you're willing to take a 12-hour bus ride, then yeah, you can get pretty much anywhere. It was when I took the decision, right, that I needed to come home because I was on a tight enough schedule. It was a 12-hour bus ride back to Reykjavik, and then spend the night in Reykjavik. And luckily enough, there was a flight the following day to get back as far as Dublin.
You're listening to theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Award-winning producers of podcasts to inform, inspire, and entertain lovers of the great outdoors everywhere.
So it's the, 28th today as we record this? 24th. 24th today. This is what, 2 weeks ago, is it, this you came back?
No, it's, I'm back a week.
Okay, and how are you now? How are your feet now? Are you walking normally now?
I wouldn't say I'm walking normally. I mean, I'm trying to spend a little bit of time in shoes and boots every day, but by the time the end of the day is finished, I mean, I had to take a drive yesterday, and by the time I got home, my feet were throbbing, and I had quite a lot of pain just underneath my toes where the blister was. So, you know, there's still issues there. I mean, I've got another kind of 10 days ish before I go back to work. So they need to be I need to be able to move about on my feet by the time I get back then.
Sure. And presumably since you've been back, you've taken further medical advice. Have they reassured you, you made the right decision at the right time?
Yes, it was the right decision. I'm going to need to get what they call metatarsal pads, which are they come in various shapes and forms. But what I've done is the ones I'm getting are an aerated type of silicone pads, which you wear underneath your socks, and they'll rewrite my foot so it's coming down properly on the ground, and it'll take the pressure off of where. You know exactly where. Apparently, it's not an unknown phenomenon. So it's my foot will be able to fall properly on the ground, and once that's happening, then it's back to training, back to getting as many Ks in as possible, and planning on going back up to Iceland next year.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I presume this is not the end. This is just a delay from your point of view. So, are you going to attempt it again the same time of year?
I won't, because of my rotations, I won't be able to go back in July of next year. So it's likely I've got to look at my timings, but, probably the earliest I could do it would be June of next year. And I have to have a look at what the weather conditions would be like. Because obviously early in the year, there's going to be a variation in weather conditions in that part of Iceland. So, I mean, given that my toothpaste froze one night in July up there, I'd probably have to bring a thicker sleeping bag.
Okay, and apart from approach shoes, I don't think there's probably anything else you'll change, is there?
Not really, no.
Apart from perhaps a crash helmet.
Well, Funny enough, you should mention that, given that I almost got taken out on the side of one of the dirt tracks up there by a camper van, a crash helmet might not be a bad idea.
Oh, I was thinking more of the turns.
Oh, well, yes. God, yeah, they were. I've been attacked by turns before, but I haven't quite had that experience at that intensity.
What was it like? Do explain.
Well, as you come out, Rauferhofen, where I started out from, I got there, put my cart together, filled up one of my water containers, which was actually more for balance, the balance of the cart, than me needing water, because there was plenty of water sources up there in that part of the country. And just outside of Rauferhofen, there's a huge, big orange sign in Icelandic. But you can see from the gist of it is the next 10K is birds. And you soon get the message as you go past, because next thing you've got this squeaking and squawking, and you're getting bashed on the head by turns, which is interesting. You end up walking 10Ks with one of your hiking poles above your head in order to keep them off.
And how long did that last for? What distance-wise?
Well, there was one section that was 10Ks long, and then the following, it was all right then for a few kilometres, and then next thing there was another sign up saying another 5Ks of turn activity.
Is there any particular advice or technique that the locals use then? Did you see anybody have a clever thing?
I haven't heard anything about what the locals do for it, but I got advice from another person who does quite a lot of long distance hiking, but in Alaska, and who is actually a bird biologist. And she advised me that what you do is you get a headband with a pair of big googly eyes off a kid's soft toy, and you wear that with the eyes pointing slightly upward, but on the back of your head. And as long as the terns reckon that you can see them, they'll leave you alone.
Okay. It's a long way to go to try that one out.
Yeah, it is. It'll be interesting testing that technique.
Yeah, big Donald Duck umbrella that pops up and sits on the top of your pack or on the top of your back somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny for about the first 5 minutes, and then I got two direct strikes on my head, which, yeah, I was lucky that because I was wearing a hat, didn't draw blood. But, you know, they are noted for anyone who's been out to the Faroe Islands during breeding season of terns there will know what it's like. That if you're not wearing a hat, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get cut.
Mm. Wow. Okay, Dermot. Well, thanks very much indeed for taking the time and filling us in with your adventures and obviously what happened. Sorry to hear that it didn't last more than 2 or 3 days. Obviously, it hasn't put you down at all, and if anything else, it's given you an experience to overcome for next time, I guess.
Well, yes, it has. And if anyone is thinking of hiking up in Iceland, all I can say it is absolutely stunning territory.
I forgot to ask you all about the actual environment. Was it everything that you hoped it would be?
It was. It was. I mean, one of the things I'll say is that it's I had experienced it in Greenland, but you experienced the same kind of Arctic environment, optical illusion, where you can see for miles and you think you're getting closer and closer to your objective because you can see it. You're 20, 30 kilometers away. But you just appear to be getting no closer. So you experience having to deal with that mental kind of, how the hell is it still over there and I'm nowhere near it. But it is beautiful terrain. I mean, it's absolutely stunning up there. The first area where I started out was this carpeted green tundra to either side of the on either side of the dirt road, and it's just non-stop sound of birds, which was fantastic for me, and being able to see so much life up there. And even walking down along the road section, you look out over the Greenland Sea towards the Arctic Circle. You have huge carpets of purple lupins all over the place, which were imported from Alaska, And you're in an almost Alaska-ish setting because you've got these black volcanic hills carpeted with green on sections of them. And you're walking past these huge alluvial rivers, which are the flow coming down from the glaciers. So it's absolutely stunning territory.
Did you see any other hikers or campers in the area at all, or were you definitely on your own?
I actually, for the first kind of day and a half, I didn't see anyone, bar a couple of farmers who drove past me. And then as I got closer to Kopaskir, which was the first village that I got to after my drop-off point, there was a few camper vans that drove past me, but I didn't see any hikers until I actually got to onto the road section. And there was a girl, Katie Hepertier, who an English girl who is, lives in France, and she, I think she has a couple of world records that she set by walking the length of the Great Wall of China. I think she was the first woman to do it. And she was doing a similar route to me. And I met her as kind of the, she was a day and a half before she finished. She was taking a slightly more direct route because she was going cross country in sections that I actually couldn't do. So she was, and she was absolutely zooming it. So I met her, stopped, managed to have a chat with her for a few minutes before she continued on. But other than that, you see plenty of hikers when you arrive in the campgrounds up there, because that area, once you're into that Aspergy Gorge area, it's quite popular for hiking. But I believe there was a few other hikers who were crossing Iceland, but I didn't actually get a chance to meet them. I think the best advice I got on preparing my feet for the next time was from a girl in the UK who said to use rock tape, and she sent me links to a YouTube links on how to tape my feet against blisters using rock tape. So I thought, well, yeah, along with using these metatarsal pads and kind of every other trick in the book, it's one of the things I'll be making sure to pack.
Well, Dermot, lovely story. Thanks very much indeed for taking the time to fill us in. And I trust that when you get ready for your return visit just before June next year, we can touch base again, and you can update me as regards, or update us all, in fact, regarding any changes you've made to obviously the gear and your approach, and hopefully prepare yourself for a successful crossing.
Absolutely. Thanks very much again, Bob.
My thanks to Dermot for taking the time to share the full story, and I'm pleased to hear that this hasn't deterred him from returning and completing the task. When you have a real job and obligations, these challenges take on a completely different meaning. Holiday time is precious, as we all know, so spare a thought for Dermot, as he's not only lost this year's time, but also next year's vacation in order to complete the task. He is, of course, doing it all for the charity Dogs for the Disabled in Ireland. And if this has inspired you to put a few pennies in the pot, the links and, of course, photos can all be found over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk show notes. That's about it from me today. I am currently lining up a whole wealth of interesting outdoors folk to talk to, not only on audio podcasts, but also live streaming. So make sure you subscribe everywhere. Until next time, folks, enjoy this glorious weather as best you can. And of course, wherever you are in the world, take care out there. Until next time, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.